Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Caroline Wang, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, I am thrilled to be interviewing Dr. Tim Rowe for our next Doctor's Playbook series episode of Alert and Oriented. Dr. Tim Rowe is a distinguished pulmonologist, critical care specialist, and educator here at Northwestern. He currently serves as an assistant professor in medicine and pulmonary critical care. Tim earned his medical degree from Loyola's Stritch School of Medicine in 2017. He completed residency at the University of Wisconsin in 2020, stayed on for a chief year, followed by his pulmonary critical care medicine fellowship here at Northwestern, finishing in 2024. During his time as a fellow, Tim's passion for education made a lasting impression on internal medicine residents and medical students rotating in the ICU. He has a passion for point-of-care ultrasound teaching and its applicability to augment our clinical reasoning in the ICU. From a scholarly perspective, Tim has focused his efforts on simulation-based mastery learning, authoring a popular study on the impact of implementing simulation-based mastery learning for the management of massive hemoptysis. Tim also shares a passion for digital medical education, spending time with the CoreIM team. Since finishing PCCM fellowship, Tim is in his first year as an attending, where with additional time spent as a core faculty member of the internal medicine residency and as the clerkship director for the critical care clerkship for Northwestern M4 students. Dr. Rowe, welcome to the Doctor's Playbook.
Thanks for having me. That's exhausting. Wow. Exhausting.
Your one-liner's getting longer.
My one-liner's getting longer, but it's been a journey, man. I feel like I just took a trip down memory lane.
We're glad to take you back, and we're gonna dive into that.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, so thank you so much for being our guest today. We're gonna dive a little bit more into just setting the stage for your medical journey. Firstly, is there anything you'd like to add about yourself from that great intro that Kevin just gave?
That was pretty good. And I mean, Kevin and I know each other a little bit. but I would also add that I'm a new dad. Most important job. So I've got an 8-month-old at home. So like, yeah, finishing fellowship, starting my new job. That was July 1st, theoretically. July 14th, my son was born. So it's been a year, man. It's been a fun one. Yeah.
Wow. So now that, you know, you are in your first year of attendinghood, what would you say is the primary focus of your current training at this point?
Training myself, you mean?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Or do you mean, I can answer that question any way you would like me to. So do you mean what I spend most of my time doing or my continuing education journey for myself?
What about we hear both?
Okay, cool. Yeah. So I'm about 50-50 in terms of my balance of clinical work and non-clinical work. In the clinical sphere, I spend time in pulmonary clinic. I attend on consult service, and then I spend a few weeks a year, about 1 week a month, in the ICU. And then in terms of my non-clinical work, I'm the co-director of the ICU clerkship for the medical school. And then, as Kevin mentioned, I'm a core faculty member in the medicine residency, which is a really exciting role for me. There in the medicine residency, I focus on simulation for procedural skills training. Okay. So like the thing that I'm most interested in doing, getting to do that with medicine residents every day.
Wow.
So that's kind of the focus of my day to day.
Wow. You have an impressive, like, typical week, it sounds like.
It's a lot of fun. That's for sure.
Yeah. It sounds like very exciting, you know, always switching it up. We're gonna, you know, go back a little bit and ask what initially drew you to medicine. And so at what point did you decide to kind of go into medicine? And then beyond that, was there anything that kind of pushed you to pursue pulmonary and critical care?
It's a way back playback.
Yeah.
Wow, I was not expecting to go this deep. Okay, so yeah, I mean, when I was in college, I was a molecular biology major, and I had transferred from Marquette to University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. And like, so I had to figure out the major system there without like the benefit of being a freshman.
Got it.
And so I chose molecular biology, and I got there and I'm like, I'm actually kind of interested in chemistry.
Oh.
And so I joined a chemistry lab, and I was like, maybe I'll do a PhD in chemistry? Is that what I want to do? Because like then you're surrounded by all these really cool people who are doing things that are interesting to you.
Right.
And I will never forget, I looked over one day at one of the grad students who was at the fume hood next to me, and his name was Tommy. He was like, I felt like kind of a kindred spirit to me. Like he was really outgoing and funny and like a prankster. And like then he's just like standing there in front of the fume hood. And like this, I'm like, this would be my life. And so like I found the science super interesting, but I was like, oh my gosh, I don't think I could do that. Yeah. And then at the same time, my day job, or my, I guess my after school job when I was in high school and college, was I was a barista. And I was like, I was good at that. I was always good at being a barista. And like, so I'm thinking to myself, like, why is it that I enjoy that? And why is it that I'm good at that? Mm. And it was because you get to connect with people, not just like on a day-to-day basis, but like you actually get to know people over time.
Right.
There's like this longitudinal relationship that you have with them. Is this starting to sound familiar to you guys?
Yeah.
And so then eventually I'm like, like maybe applying science and, you know, sort of communication and education might be what I want to do. And I think it was like there where I started to think, well, maybe medicine is the career for me. And then, you know, I went through the typical thing that all pre-medical students do, which is like having a series of people that you care about and care about you tell you that you shouldn't do medicine because of X, Y, and Z. And, you know, I think I kind of, you know, went through that for a while and then ultimately recognized that this was the way to combine the things that I was good at and the things that I had trained in with, like, you know, sort of an application that would be fulfilling to me. So that was medicine. And then, like, internal medicine, palm crit. I guess once I had sort of started residency in medicine, the thing that drew me to pulmonary and critical care initially is not what I find most rewarding about it now, I guess is what I would say.
Interesting.
I love procedures. I love working with my hands, probably going back to being a barista and being like mechanically oriented from that perspective. It makes me feel coordinated, which I'm not coordinated in my everyday life. So like, that's like a good thing for me. And so I think that was like originally, I'm like, oh, the ICU is cool because you get to work with your hands a ton. But when I got there, I think it was two things that kept me there. It was application of foundational physiology at the bedside, which is the reason that I love being a critical care educator now. And it was the ability to have these high stakes conversations with people that you've, in most cases, like just met, right? Like meeting somebody and learning about them very deeply, very quickly, so that you can map their goals, preferences, and wishes to one of the most important decisions of their lives.
Yeah.
Is like such a privilege. I mean, it sounds like kind of trite to say it, but like it's very true. It is such a privilege to be able to do that. And I think if you ask me like, why is it that you still enjoy critical care today? Those conversations are the reason that I do.
Wow. That is powerful, and you are making me want to
do it.
Do it right now.
It's not too late, right?
You already got you're an intern.
This is the whole reason you asked me on here, right, Kevin? This is a hearts and minds tour. Okay, good. I just want to make sure.
I'm going to send this episode to my mom as well. Shout out to my mom. She's a COVID-19 ICU pulmonary nurse, and so she's actually been on the journey to convince me to do pulm crit ICU care.
That is, and those are the heroes.
Yeah. She is absolutely a hero.
Shout out to Caroline's mom.
Yes. Wow. And, you know, this is really pushing me towards that. So she'll be very happy.
One thing I didn't. Did you go to Urbana-Champaign?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We were both Jesuit transfers to UIUC.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, because you started at.
I was Holy Cross.
You were Holy Cross, right? Right. You and Anthony
to
Fauci.
MCB, yeah.
Yeah. Wait, you were an MCB major?
I was an MCB guy. Yeah.
So did you think about IB at all?
No.
Yeah, me
was,
either.
Was not me.
Nah.
But I missed the freshman experience, too.
Yeah.
Did not have the hood experience that you shared, though.
It's hard, though. Like, I mean, and I think this is, like, an experience that recapitulates itself in life. Like, when you join a group of people after that, after identity formation has already taken place, whether that's you're transferring into a medical school or a college or you're transferring into a residency or you did your training somewhere and then you go somewhere else for your first job, like, it's tough, man. Like that's an experience that continues to be really challenging, and especially at a place like U of I, which is gigantic.
Huge, right?
Yeah, it was hard. I didn't know that.
Oh. I loved it though. Best 3 years.
Yeah, seriously.
And now you guys are here together, sitting across the table.
Our long journey to one another has.
It kind of seems like I'm copying him.
Yeah.
No. Following in his footsteps. Well, you know, speaking of teaching and like mentoring, one question we had for you was, what's your secret sauce to excellent teaching and diagnostic development, especially in those students that you're mentoring?
I mean I hesitate to say that I like truly, like, all joking aside, I hesitate to say I have, like, a secret sauce. I still consider myself to be very much a work in progress as an educator. Mm-hmm. But if you're wondering, like, what is a strategy if I'm out there and I'm, like, a resident or a fellow and I'm thinking that I want to be a clinician educator, like, how do I get better? I think a couple of things. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of developing your skills, you need to find other people. They don't have to be in the exact field that you want to go into, but you need to find other people that you look up to, mm-hmm. and you need to emulate them, but also ask them how it was they developed their teaching style. So for me, like in the last, you know, 5 years, the most important education mentor that I've had is Mac Walter, who's one of our pulmonary critical care doctors here. And, you know, he was one of the major reasons I wanted to come to Northwestern for fellowship after I interviewed and chatted with him. But like, very quickly, as a first-year fellow, when I would attend sessions he would give, I recognized the amount of like thought and thoughtfulness that went into his teaching. And so like having those mentors and also like naming them, like telling them, hey, like you're somebody that I look up to, you're somebody that I'm learning from, mm-hmm. so that they can you know, register that, and so that they take the time to give you hard feedback on education sessions. As Mac has watched me teach in the past and has said things to me that like in the moment I'm like, man, like, he doesn't mean anything by it, but like that's tough. But in retrospect, like it is the tough love that helps you to improve. So that's like, if you want to be a good educator, I guess what I'm saying is find good educators and mm-hmm. learn from them.
Right.
And again, like that can sound very vague. Like people tell you to read if you want to get better at medicine.
Right.
But like actually, what I mean is like watch them, find things about their teaching style that resonates with you. Mm-hmm. Ask them to watch you teach, and then mm-hmm. ask them for feedback.
Got it.
That's one thing. Mm-hmm. And then when you think about like your interaction as a teacher with learners, mm-hmm. like how do I, like if I am effective as a teacher with medical students or residents, how is it that happens? It's you get to know them as a person first, right? Like mm-hmm. you do the best you can to understand what they're bringing to the table in terms of like, why are they motivated as a learner in that particular setting? Mm-hmm. Recognize that that changes over time. I work with fourth year medical students primarily, right?
Right.
Like I work with people in their ICU clerkship in our phase three here. And so like, that's a very different experience than somebody who hasn't done their clinical rotations or somebody who is starting their core clerkships, right?
Yeah.
The things that motivate a fourth year learner are not the same as those that motivate a phase one or phase two learner. But that doesn't mean that they're not motivated. Mm-hmm. So now they're thinking, I'm going to be a resident very soon.
Right.
The calls are going to be coming to me. The early decisions are going to be mine to make, and I want to make sure that I do right by my patients. And so finding where you can engage a learner, I think, is the secret sauce for anybody, really, if that makes sense.
Wow. Yeah, that is so helpful to know. And I really like your point about, like, you know, getting to know them as a person and then, you know, figuring out their motivation and kind of gearing it towards how they, you know, maybe learn best or what they're looking forward to in the future.
It's interesting too, like the learn best kind of thing and like the self-perception of learning best. There is a study that I was a part of that we never published this study, but it was a multi-institution study that involved Northwestern looking at self-directed learning practices and like mm-hmm. self-report of self-directed learning practices.
Yeah.
And I think one of the biggest takeaways that I had from that experience is that actually like the thing that you report as your preferred learning modality is not necessarily the right learning modality for you.
Oh.
That is not necessarily the case, right? And so like it's important to know that like I say that because effortful learning, difficult learning is oftentimes something that we avoid, not consciously, but like we subconsciously try to do things that are like a little bit easier on the inertia side.
Yeah.
So I won't say that like it's like ask the student how do you want to learn and package it that way for them. It's really like figure out how it is that you're going to hold their attention and tell the story in a way that's compelling to them, tell the story in a way that matches their level of understanding and expertise and takes them a little bit beyond their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't teach ICU physiology to you the same way that I would to a fourth year medical student. I can't teach it to you the same way that I would a third year pulmonary critical care fellow.
Mm-hmm.
The things I have to teach those people are different.
Yeah.
And so it's that's part of it too.
Got it. Yeah, it's really, it sounds like there's a lot of like evolving, you know, kind of personalizing to fit every student or resident. And then even for your own personal journey, it sounds like you've also grown a lot. So our next question is, how has your clinical reasoning evolved from residency to fellowship to attending? Are there strategies now that you didn't use as often earlier in training?
That's a good question. I think that the more times I see, and I'm just thinking about the ICU right now, like the more times I see critical physiology recapitulate itself, the less I think I know about it. And I don't think that that's like unique, right? Like I think what I'm describing is like the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Yeah, like the more, I think I know more now than I did when I was a first year fellow, but I don't always feel like I know more now. What I am more comfortable with is, you know, sort of A, operating with some degree of uncertainty about what's going on. That is to say, like, I'm not necessarily going to solve the problem of what's going on with this person today, but I need to know what is it that I need to do to keep them safe and what is it that I need to evaluate to understand this better. So yeah, I think being more comfortable with, as they say, don't just do something, stand there, right? Like sometimes not doing interventions and observing what happens is the right thing to do. So I think I'm becoming more comfortable with that as time goes on.
So I know that the ICU is very complex. You know, a lot of patients might present with multiple organ failures. And do you have a favorite framework or mental model that you'll find yourself using frequently in these critical care cases?
A single framework, I would say no. And that's the beauty of the ICU, right, is that, like, you get to see derangements in physiology, but you also get to see, you know, really rare diseases present precipitously. You get to deal with relatively routine things that kind of become maybe even a little bit mundane after a period of time. But like, there's a lot of variety to what I see. So it would be hard to apply one framework. I think the thing that I found most helpful, and Kevin, you're going to start doing this soon as the fellow, is like, you're getting called for an ICU bed. And so like, the default position that you want to take as the, you know, trainee taking that call or the person taking that call is like, how can I help you? In other words, why is it that you are concerned this patient needs a higher level of care? And I think like that is the framework that I started to approach new patient consultations with, because it can become overwhelming. Sometimes people call you because there's a real, you know, concrete reason. This patient's in respiratory failure, they're on non-rebreather and they don't look good, we need high flow now and we might need to intubate them. Like, that's different. But sometimes they call you because they're like, there's something that's not right, and I don't know what it is, but I need somebody else to look at this patient. Those are different consults, and both of those can be completely appropriate, and both of those can be ICU admissions. But I think having the framework of like, why is this really smart person asking for my help to take care of this patient is the way that I try to approach it.
Got it, yeah. You have a lot of like really insightful takeaways.
Oh, thanks.
Especially like in terms of mental models, and then I feel like walking us through like how you think. Kind of on the topic of critical care again, since there is so much rapid decision making, how have you personally balanced the speed and also kind of like the detail you need in those high stakes situations?
In a lot of ways, I think that the way that you process information changes because of the structure of the team, right? Like when you're a medical student reporting absolutely every detail, but also the report that you're giving is the iceberg and you have all this other knowledge about the patient beneath the surface that you're waiting to mobilize if they have a, if the resident fellow attending has a question about it. Now you're a resident and maybe you're presenting, or maybe you're standing back and watching somebody else do it, but ready to chime in and making sure that if the presentation is going off the rails, if the data being presented doesn't support what you're concerned is happening, redirecting things, that's a different task. When you're a fellow, it's basically making sure at the end of the conversation that the two or three critical reasons the patients in the ICU have been addressed adequately, and then after rounds, making sure that the plan is executed correctly. When you're the attending, if you have reliable team members, which you usually do at great places like Northwestern, if you have reliable team members in each of those positions, really, you're there as a support and to be the person that's documenting everything that's happening. So that for posterity's sake, in the medical record. And so that also leaves you, I think, with, you know, a little bit of time to sit back and say, what are the one or two things that we need to come back as a team together and talk about from a learning point perspective? And I'm still really like, this is the part of clinical medicine that I'm now struggling with the most, is incorporating learning points that are sufficiently like novel information that it's not going to be boring for me to tell the learners. Sufficiently, you know, not esoteric, I suppose, like not so esoteric that like it only is interesting for the pulmonary fellow, right? That it's not overwhelming to the learner in the method that I'm delivering it. So I'm not like making rounds draw out for like two extra hours so that I can, you know, sort of stand on my soapbox and make points that nobody wants to hear after their attention span has already dwindled. And then also so that like I'm not, you know, unable to function as a human being when I'm on service. Because like right now, and this is probably going to change as time goes on, but the way that I'm achieving that is a way that I observed Mac doing it when I was a fellow, which is that I'll pick one or two points as rounds go on. I'll write them on my list. Like, I want to talk about this, this, and this. And then I will send an email to the team that basically consolidates that in the evening. Over time, I think that I'm creating, obviously, like a register of learning pearls that I can hopefully redeploy because these things do recapitulate themselves.
Yeah.
But right now, on the front end, as a first-year faculty, it basically means that every time I want to write one of those emails, I'm spending a significant amount of time. I mean, like 30, 45 minutes writing an email after a long day of ICU service when you have an infant at home. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
So it takes commitment. I don't know if I answered the question.
I think you brought it even to a better pathway, honestly. I think now we can kind of delve into your prowess in teaching and mentorship. And one of our questions we had was, if you had to teach a medical student or resident one of those pearls that you have saved up, which one would it be right now?
Oh, so like if I had to pick one learning pearl?
You can pick your favorite few.
My favorite thing to talk about in the ICU, like, because you can teach it anytime, is the vent. And like, I think like things that make people anxious about the ventilator, I love to like help people feel more comfortable with those things because that for me was always like the ventilator was like this black box and like this really like special, almost like sacred knowledge that the fellow had when I was a student and resident and I was coming into the ICU for the first couple of times. I was like, wow, like, someday if I could understand that would be really cool. And I'm still trying my best to learn more about it every day, and fortunately surrounded by people that know a lot more about mechanical ventilation than I do and continuing to learn from them. But like now that I have a sort of a foundational baseline of knowledge, one of my favorite things to do every month with the medicine ICU clerkship is to do our mechanical ventilation sim, where we go through, you know, basic vent settings, modes of ventilation, but also alarms that you commonly encounter, like P pressure alarms, and how to differentiate that. So that's something that I love doing. And like every time that comes up on rounds organically, I'm like, yes, like, this is good.
This is my
I have a memory of Tim moonlighting in the ICU when I was an intern on ICU nights. And
you probably didn't want a learning pearl at that moment.
Just to share his passion, but we did like, you know, night rounds at 11 or something, and I remember
night rounds.
So do I. And I remember it very vividly, Tim 15 minutes in a room walking through a ventilator at night. And
wow.
I don't know, it's like different time when you're doing it at night, and it sticks. Sticks when you're learning it there at the bedside.
If you can connect learning points, like if you're like, how do I get good at teaching, or how do I make an impact as a teacher? If you can connect a learning point to a patient somebody's taking care of, that's a really powerful thing. And like that's always the challenge, is like you have this body of knowledge when you're a medical trainee that's learning how to teach. You have this body of knowledge that's getting greater and greater as time goes on.
Right.
Maybe you're not feeling as confident in it, but it is. It's building. It's accumulating.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, you have this pool of patients that you're taking care of. But like connecting the learning points that you can make to those patients is not always easy.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really makes a difference, though.
Yeah. So do you have any strategies for connecting that kind of bridge between the two? And especially like as medical students and residents are sharpening our diagnostic reasoning, we kind of come in to you with this giant, like, boat of knowledge, and we have very little experience so far, like narrowing it down to one diagnosis or what we want to focus on. So what do you kind of do to lead those medical students and residents in that way?
I think what I do now, like when I'm on service in the ICU, I typically, like when I go home, I'll continue reading as like people come in. If it's an admission cycle, I'll read, you know, any H&P that gets appended before I go to bed. And then in the morning, I'll wake up, you know, a little bit early so that I can read anything that has come in overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I'm like coming to work, if I'm biking in or I'm on the bus, I'm just thinking like, what are one or two things that I can, you know, sort of point out.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think trying to be a little bit thoughtful as a teacher, like trying to be a little bit thoughtful in advance of what you want to teach about.
Yeah.
And then just in full disclosure, like a lot of times I'm not prepared to just give an off the cuff you know, chalk talk on that. And so it might involve refreshing my knowledge. And so then, like, when I'm on service in the ICU, I'm often like, if you see me on the bus on the way to work when I'm on service, I usually am like preparing some sort of, I'm brushing up my knowledge of something or preparing some sort of a short discussion. And then I try to deploy that on rounds. I think it's really challenging though, because like, mm-hmm. finding a learning point and delivering it on rounds for every patient, even if you had like the best points to give and were the most compelling teacher, which I'm not, but if you were, like, that would not be the right thing to do, because you would be extending rounds, you would be making it harder for your residents to do the work they needed to. The nighttime people would be mad at you because you weren't letting them go home. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not effective. So it's all of those things, but then also finding the right forum to deliver that learning point. And I wish I could tell you I know the way to do it. I'm still trying to figure that out.
It sounds like you have a good grasp, and like, you already have a lot of great points. You know, like, I like how you're also kind of acknowledging that like, not every single patient is always the best time. It's kind of also catered to what it works best for you and also the learner. And maybe let's kind of take a different view and see, maybe when you were a fellow or a resident, were there any clinical scenarios that challenged your diagnostic reasoning, and were there any scenarios that shaped your teaching today?
That's a good question. I mean, of course the answer is yes. I'm trying to think of examples now. I think, you know, things that sort of shaped my diagnostic reasoning or my understanding of physiology were, you know, some teachers that I had when I was in residency who taught me about the utility of critical care ultrasound. I think, like, that is something that I'm very interested in. It's interesting because it's a hot topic, right? Like, what is the right amount of critical care ultrasound knowledge? Mm-hmm. Should all residents learn how to do critical care ultrasound and learn how to get cardiac views and apply those? Mm-hmm. At what point can we entrust them to do that and not make the wrong decision with that information? Should fellows learn advanced techniques and you know, take echo boards? Mm-hmm. Should it be all fellows? Should it be some fellows? Should our faculty do it too? How do we capture those examinations and make sure that they're done in a responsible manner? How do we document the decisions we're making based off of that? Like, those things are really fascinating to me. So I think, like, the thing that was most impactful to me were some of my early ultrasound educators who taught me that the physiology principles that I had learned in my preclinical years in medical school could actually be applied and, you know, hypotheses tested at the bedside. You're not always right, right? Like, your hypothesis is not always correct. As Ben Singer says in the context of shock and volume responsiveness, the best determinant of volume responsiveness in shock is give volume and see if there's a response. but I think we should always be endeavoring to stack up, you know, the more points of data that you have that point in one direction, right? This patient's hypotensive, is it a volume responsive state or not, being the perfect example, right? Like, the more physical exam, ultrasound exam, you know, sort of hemodynamic monitoring points that you can add up that point in one direction, I think the more certainty that you have, and then collect that information serially and revise your hypothesis over time. But like, to stick our head in the sand and say, this is not useful because, you know, the validity evidence on its use show, you know, that there are errors with inter-rater reliability and that, you know, people can interpret the data incorrectly, and just say, like, we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, I don't think that's correct either. I think we should be striving for a more perfect understanding of critical physiology. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to have that, more people need to learn how to use it at the bedside.
Got it. Yeah, it sounds like your passion, you know, for, like, ultrasound and like, integrating these skills is very, very strong. And how do you approach teaching the role or teaching its role in enhancing clinical reasoning for those younger trainees, especially since I know you are integrating a lot of digital resources into the diagnostic approach?
I think, like, one thing is recognizing that you don't always need to reinvent the wheel as it comes to educational resources. Mm-hmm. When I was a resident, my co-resident and I, our like major educational project was to create a point of care ultrasound curriculum for the interns that all categorical interns completed, because we didn't have any ultrasound training back at that point for our residency program. And I think it was really intimidating on the front end. We had a content expert at our institution who was willing to share his case logs with us, which was really helpful. But like, still, I felt compelled to like create out of the ether our own curriculum. And that took a lot of time and effort that I could have spent elsewhere. I could have spent that time refining my own technique and getting better in my ultrasound examinations. I could have spent that time thinking about how to approach it from a scholarly perspective or ensure sustainability after I left residency. But instead, I spent a lot of that time just like creating the didactic content itself. Mm-hmm. And that's a good exercise. Like learning how to create a curriculum is an important thing to do if you want to be a clinician educator. Mm-hmm. But there are so many good resources out there, like just thinking about critical care ultrasound, that are free, open access, and are meant to be shared. And I think that we should be leveraging that. So that's a big part of like how I teach ultrasound now, is I try to sort of map the skill that the learner is trying to obtain to an existing resource out there. Mm-hmm. And then I think also to recognize that it's tempting to try to teach an entire examination, like the full cardiac examination or the lung examination, or, you know, if you're an emergency doctor, the FAST or EFAST examination, or, you know, these protocols, like teach it all at once. But the more that I have taught it with individual learners, the more I recognize that, like, we have to be a little bit, we have to acknowledge that people obtain these skills at different speeds,
right,
and set our goals a little bit differently. Like for me, if I spend an hour with a resident and what they learn is how to hold the probe correctly and what happens to an image when you fan one way or the other, and that's all they learn, mm-hmm, and they get one view the whole time and they don't have anything to interpret out of it and they don't get the rest of the views, to me, if they have learned that lesson, that is still a worthwhile hour from my perspective.
Yeah.
Because you can learn, the basics in 20 minutes just looking on the computer, but you can spend years refining, as I still am, like you can spend years refining your actual technique in acquisition and bedside interpretation.
Wow. Yeah. We do a little bit of ultrasound at Rush sometimes. I'll like, you know, bring us into the sim center, but I never realized it was like, there was so much, you know, for me to always continue picking up on, and I'm very excited to continue with that.
I think the thing too, like if you're a learner out there and you're listening to this and you're like, man, I wish I was better at ultrasound, but like I'm intimidated to start because like I don't really know what I'm doing or looking at.
Right.
I think I'd encourage you to recognize a couple of things. First of all, the biggest expenditure that is incurred when you do a bedside ultrasound exam is your time. Mm-hmm. It does not involve ionizing radiation, right? So it's not like you're exposing the patient to significant harm to do it. Mm-hmm. It is patient-centered. It brings you to the bedside. Mm-hmm. And then here's a really important thing. The patient doesn't know if you know what you're looking at or not, right? They don't. And I know that's funny, but like it's true, right? Like I think there's a lot of self-consciousness that is counterproductive. You have to recognize that if you want to use this skill to help patients, there's going to be a period of time where you're scanning and you don't know what you're looking at. And that's okay. Every person who has ever learned point of care ultrasound has gone through that period, whether they're willing to admit that to you or not. Mm-hmm. And if you're not willing to, and this is like a universal like learning theme, right? Like if you're not willing to be uncomfortable with your lack of knowledge and experience, then you are doing yourself a huge disservice as a learner.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's a
go
really,
out there and scan.
I will. Next time we have it, I'll be standing there for hours and hours after. I guess one question I've always had about like COVID-19 specifically in pulmonary critical care is that I know that COVID really put the pulmonary critical care field in the spotlight. And have you seen like emerging trends or changes in the landscape, and have those kind of translated to the ultrasound and the critical care environment?
Yeah, I mean, COVID was a tough period of time, understatement, right? Like for all of us, I think anybody who works in healthcare, it was a difficult time. I'm sure your mom came home with stories, and it was an interesting time for me personally because I was a third year resident, like in that, you know, sort of February where it all started, and then it was my chief year, which ended up being a lot of clinical work as well, you know, sort of during the meat of the first sort of wave of the pandemic. And then, you know, fellowship through, what was it, the Delta wave and et cetera, like, you know, in the later part of the pandemic. So it really, in a lot of ways, shaped the way I understand, you know, sort of medicine in general, and especially critical care medicine. It changed the way I think about the privilege of being able to have family present at the bedside. Mm-hmm. To assist in decision making, you know, as I was saying earlier, like that, I think is one of the most important value adds that a critical care physician actually brings to the table is you know, sort of mapping our knowledge to your preferences as a patient or as a loved one. And it was so terrible to not be able to have loved ones readily available at the bedside, sometimes in really difficult moments. And then, like, I mean, like, those few cases that I can think of where patients died and their family actually wasn't there in the hospital, and we were the only ones, the care team were the only ones, the nurses, the doctors were the only ones who could be there with the patient. Like, that has changed the way I think that I think about my job as a physician. And I'm sure that your mom would say the same thing for her role as well. In terms of, you know, the way that we approach medicine, I think that I'm too young in my career to, like, have a long view on that. I don't think I'm the right person to ask about that, because, again, it was, like, in such a formative time for me that it's almost all that I know. I would say what was interesting about the pandemic in general, and I don't think this insight is unique, is, like, it changed the rapidity with which we could amass knowledge. And the biggest challenge, I think, at least is, like, in my understanding from the critical care perspective, I think the biggest challenge we had is, like, knowing with all of this literature that was being produced around the subject, like, what the quality of that was and how to approach applying it at the bedside. And the history of, you know, trials in critical care medicine is a history of trying to find a way to marginally improve patient-centered outcomes like mortality, and oftentimes thinking that you have found that sort of secret sauce, and then finding out that actually when you try to recapitulate that wasn't the case. The, you know, best example from the last, you know, 25 years is early goal-directed therapy, the Manny Rivers trial, which was, you know, they attempted to replicate it three different times in different multi-center studies in different parts of the world, and each time we're unable to replicate that really impressive mortality benefit that was observed in the original trial. So, like, that's like almost like the story of critical care is, like, it's really hard to move the needle on mortality. But, like, I think that COVID added a little bit of an extra complexity to it, in that just, like, the volume of literature that was coming out was, you know, by necessity, and with good reason, was exceptional. But, like, I think it was hard to know, like, what to do with that information. And, like, when does that become standard of care? Like, when is this, like, we're just trying something experimentally? When is this, like, this is probably okay? And then, like, when is it, like, standard of care?
Got it. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, the critical care environment, you already have, like, a million things on your plate, and you have to refine your diagnosis, and this kind of also added an extra layer, especially during that time. I guess if we're going to talk about critically ill patients as well, when you evaluate a patient who's very critically ill, maybe they have respiratory distress, what are some key first principles that you've been relying on to structure your clinical reasoning?
So, in other words, I'm called to the bedside of somebody who has respiratory distress. What am I paying attention to? I talk to them, or try to talk to them, right? Like, sometimes it's hard because they already have, like, the BiPAP mask on, and then you're like, okay, I can't really hear you. But, like, actually, like, if you're there at that moment where this first becomes apparent, and, like, you're able to be part of that first evaluation, and you can have a conversation with them, see how they're able to string together a full sentence, or whether it's just a couple of words. What does their breathing pattern look like? So, in other words, are they recruiting strap muscles? Are they using their abdominal muscles to breathe, right? Like, those sorts of things are really, really helpful. Are they diaphoretic with their breathing? Are they somnolent? Like, these are all things that are on kind of a spectrum of concerning in somebody who has respiratory distress. Gas exchange, of course, is important. If you have the ability to get an arterial gas, I think, like, that's helpful in a lot of circumstances, particularly if you're trying to decide physiologically what's causing the respiratory failure. Then, you know, you can, if you get an arterial gas and you know what the FiO2 is that they're sort of on at that time, you can calculate an AA gradient and determine whether the AA gradient is elevated or not, and help to narrow your differential that way. If you think about the things that cause respiratory failure with hypoxemia that have a normal AA gradient, a lot of those are, like, not necessarily something that you're going to see in the hospital. For example, low FiO2 outside of a burning building, we don't really see that on Earth. Atmospheric pressure is not changing substantially. We're in Chicago here, you know, relatively close to sea level. But I think it's still a useful exercise to learn how to do. And then, obviously, you know, getting diagnostic information is helpful. So I think the physical examination gets you a lot of the way. I think that you can develop a gestalt of, like, sick or not sick. Does this patient need a higher level of care? just through observation in a lot of cases, but then it's time to move to imaging. And I think you can use your clinical examination and your history to inform what type of imaging is going to be necessary in that moment. Do I just need a semi-upright chest x-ray, in which case we can call for it right now? Or do I think that I need to do cross-sectional imaging? Do I think I need to do a PE study? And then if that's the case, and this is the fun part for you next year, Kevin, is like, do I feel like it's safe for this patient to go for that more definitive imaging study? Or do I think that the risk associated with that might be, you know, too much at this moment in time? That's where I think you rely a lot on your nursing colleagues in respiratory therapy, who know, you know, who have a lot of knowledge that I think is under appreciated and under tapped in these circumstances.
Wow. Yeah. Really love the insights, especially about something we've noticed across all these different interviews is like the physical exam at the end of the day is like so important, and so much can be extrapolated from that. And Dr. Abrams in one of our previous episodes also kind of mentioned how the physical exam, like the history behind it, and in a sense it was almost when it was first being developed, like almost preventative in a way, you know, just checking sick or not sick. And that's so important to make a distinction between. We're kind of jumping around between your perspectives and your clinical reasoning and also the amazing work you do as a teacher and mentor. But let's say you have a trainee and you have all this information and you want to teach them to refine their differential diagnosis beyond maybe anchoring on a single possibility or any like cognitive biases. How do you do that?
So if it's somebody that I'm rounding with, I think I start with like, what is the data that they're presenting before their assessment in their presentation? I always try to encourage like the medical students on the clerkship, the information that you're sharing with me in the ICU cannot be all of the information that's in the chart, right? Like there's no possible way. There's too much information in the chart, and that's not the point.
Yeah.
When you are sharing information with us on rounds, I think you're telling us, I think this is important, and I'm going to use it to tell a story about what I think is going on. So like that is where I tend to start with, like if I have a concern that a learner needs help, like, you know, sort of refining their clinical reasoning, I think I start with like, what objective data do they think is important for me to know? Because it's a different conversation, I think, if you have all the right data and then you're drawing conclusions that I don't necessarily know how to follow, versus if you're just like, I can see that the fire hose of data is exceeding your ability to process, or you haven't developed an approach to that. Those are two different conversations. So I think that's often where I will start. And I think you have to like approach it with some humility, right? Like Ted Lasso said, be curious, not judgmental. Like, just because somebody doesn't have the experience that you have in medicine doesn't mean that they don't have a lot of knowledge, even about a subject, an illness that maybe you haven't spent as much time thinking about or haven't encountered in a while. Right. So like, I never start as a teacher, such as I am, like I would never start with the presupposition that I have all of the information and the learner is just there to learn from me. So typically like when people are saying things that don't align with my understanding, and I think about like the person who I saw do this so well when I was a fellow was Mike Cutica, one of our pulmonary hypertension doctors. Like, I don't know if you've ever worked with him before, but like, obviously he's brilliant, right? And has a ton of knowledge about critical care medicine, about pulmonary vascular disease. But whenever you say something that he either doesn't agree with or doesn't know to be true, he never approaches it from like, oh, you're wrong, let me help you with this. He's more like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, tell me more about that. And like, I mean, you can't do that with every point that doesn't resonate with you as a teacher, but like, I actually think that's a really important approach, because not only does it show your learner that you value their knowledge, expertise, and like at this point, every learner that I'm working with is an incredibly intelligent person who has worked a ton and is deserving of my respect and expertise, right? Like, or my respect and my you know, sort of partnership, I guess. But also like recognizing that if you have this closed off view in your teaching, then you're never going to learn anything. From the point that you become an attending, everything is now unidirectional. And that is, none of us stayed in academic medicine because that's what we wanted, right? If you're at an academic center especially, but I think if you're in medicine in general, you are committed to a lifetime of learning things. Otherwise, it's not a very fun career, I don't think.
So.
Yeah, wow. I'm very inspired by like your outlook on teaching and like how you're always open to learning more. I'm sure your trainees and residents and fellows also really appreciate that as well. I think one more personal insight question that I would love to hear your response is, if you could go back and give advice to your younger self just starting residency, what would it be?
That's a good question. I think, like, more commitment to protecting my personal life as a resident. Something about me that a lot of people don't know is when I was a resident, when I was an intern, actually, my mom was diagnosed unexpectedly with lung cancer. And I was in Madison and she was in southeastern Wisconsin, a smaller town at that point in time. She moved to Madison to be at an academic center and get her treatment. Mm-hmm. And when I was a third year resident, she died, which was awful. Like, it's a terrible experience to go through. Yeah. But I think, like, what I recognize from that experience, not that, like, this is an experience that anyone would ever desire to have, is that I had really to that point given like lip service to protecting work-life balance, but not actually done that. And it was only in a moment of like crisis where I'm like, oh, actually the time that I have with my mom is like really finite. Did I like actually start to work on that in my personal and professional life? Yeah. And I think when you're a medical trainee, because of all the pressure that the system puts on us, like, because of how high the bar is now to succeed and continue to move to that next step, like, I think that we have a tendency to say that we are protecting wellness and our life and actually not do that. And, like, I'm still guilty of that, as my wife will tell you. I'm not perfect as far as that goes. But, like, now, as a dad, like, I do have the ability and the will and, you know, we'll continue to make efforts to, like, actually try to protect time where, like, I'm at home, I'm with my family, I'm not mm-hmm. thinking about work, mm-hmm. I'm not pulling out my phone and looking at my email, like, I'm actually truly present in the moment. That, I think, is really important. And I wish I had thought about that before. I think residency would have been easier for me if I had. I don't think I'd be a worse doctor for it. I think I'd be, if we do this, I think we become better human beings and we are able to take care of our patients more deeply because we are still engaged with the reality of living and like putting things in priority that are important.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm sure that like many residents and fellows will resonate with a lot of the takeaways that you shared today.
And if you're a trainee that's going through that, I would say, like, I mean, like, at the time it happened, I knew that what I should be doing was taking a leave, mm-hmm. and I didn't know how to do that. Every situation is different, but I'm sure there are people out there listening that are going through something like this where it's like, man, I'm not sure when she's going to get really sick that she's going to need me. And if I use my leave now, mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm going to have it when I need it. Yeah. And, the sort of backup for this is if you have to extend your training, you extend your training. And I think that a lot of people, myself included, want to avoid that. If I could go back in time, I would not have been so reluctant to take that leave when I thought I needed it. Like, if you have to extend your training in the grand scheme of things to be present for a loved one when they're sick, I think that that's a worthwhile thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so if you're listening and that's something you're thinking about, I would say, like, man, you know, something, it's a tough decision to make, but I think it's the right decision to make if you have to.
We have one last question for you to cap off a really amazing interview today. So looking forward in your next many years of attendinghood and teaching and being a wonderful doctor, what is one goal or maybe even like a couple goals that you have personally that you are really looking forward to achieving and setting on the path towards?
Yeah. Right now what I'm thinking a lot about is, like, as an educator, what animates me? And like what, you know, so I'm a UME undergraduate medical education educator and I'm a GME graduate medical education educator, right? Like, I do a lot in the medical school and with the residency. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's exciting to me is to see how whatever clinical expertise I develop or am developing over time, how that can be leveraged most effectively to work with the learners that I work with in the future. So, like, what is it going to be that is sort of the underpinning of all the educational sort of roles that I have? I think it's going to be using simulation in scenarios or procedures that happen infrequently but are important to
do correctly, using simulation to make that safer for our patients, less intimidating for our trainees, and studying the effect of that and demonstrating that, that actually it's worth dedicating time and resources to. I think that's what's going to animate me. But like, I don't know exactly, if you ask me like, what procedures do you mean, or what learners are you talking about, or right. how are you going to assess that?
Yeah.
I'm still in early days with that. So that's what I'm really excited to know. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
That sounds so exciting. And Kevin, I'm sure you will, you know, get to see a lot of that come to fruition.
Yeah, he has no choice. he'll be a subject of that learning.
I mean, I'm wrapping up my last 3 months of residency, and just this conversation is so inspiring, Tim.
Oh, thanks.
So thank you for coming. It's just so illuminating how passionate you are about what you do, but also how dedicated and deliberate you are.
I appreciate you saying that. I never would have thought of myself that way as deliberate. I feel like I'm just running around.
You described so many qualities of like a professional athlete. Like you approach things that you do as a skill that needs deliberate practice, and you actively think about how to do those things better. Mm-hmm. And it's such a cool skill and passion.
So I can go home today and tell my wife that a former collegiate baseball player told me that I remind him of a professional athlete, and I can quote you on that. Yeah, okay.
You have it on air, too.
Great. Amazing. Okay. Amazing. Well, thank you guys for having me. I'm so glad to have been able to have this conversation with you.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. And I think that's the end to a wonderful episode. Thank you so much for tuning in.